This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is out. I'm Brooke Gladstone. We've really been confronting ourselves this week, seeing ourselves in mostly unflattering high def, like it or not, in the people who represent us, in photo ops clutching Bibles and fancy handbags, in uniform firing flash bombs to maintain the established order, and in the streets with banners and outstretched arms trying to overturn that order. So who are we, really?
Mattis released a statement today that reads in part, Donald Trump is the first president in my lifetime who does not try to unite the American people, does not even pretend to try. Instead, he tries to divide us.
How do we see ourselves?
What you thought was going to happen? They need jobs, feed our babies, and we wouldn't have this problem.
So you think a lot of this is born out of frustration?
Yes, they're sick and tired of being sick and tired. And this is what sick and tired looks like.
And how do others see us?
Ici à Washington, ils marchent vers la Maison Blanche en colère contre les violences policières.
Diferentes partes del país por la muerte de George Floyd a manos de la policía en Minneapolis.
We saw protesters tear gas yesterday to make way for a presidential photo op. I'd like to ask you what you think about that. And if you don't want to comment, what message do you think you're sending?
Here, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau paused for a very long 20 seconds or so. But I'm not supposed to air all that on the radio. Silence sounds like a mistake.
We all watch in horror and consternation what's going on in the United States. It is a time.
Great powers, if they are to remain great, must take note of how they're viewed.
We made more good news for the Axis today.
That's newsman Chet Huntley in June 1943, commenting acidly on the riots initiated by U.S. servicemen against young Mexican-American men, many of whom were invited, though resented by local whites, to provide wartime labor. Some sported the edgy baggy suits popularized in Harlem, zoot suits. They were called the Zoot Suit Riots, and they were brutal.
The open warfare in Los Angeles has been broadcast by our enemies in every foreign tongue and beamed toward all the continents, the nations, and all the islands where other races of people live. The Axis says, in short, here's your vaunted democracy in action.
An image problem, a moral problem, that our nation cannot outrun.
Today we gave the Axis more good news, gave our enemies some more weapons. There was a lynching in Florida and a race riot last night in Beaumont, Texas.
As the country marks 100,000 deaths from the coronavirus pandemic, the former British colony finds itself in a downward spiral of ethnic violence.
That's Karen Atiyya, Washington Post Global Opinions editor, reading from her recent column, How Western Media Would Cover Minneapolis If It Happened in Another Country. She got the idea a little over a week ago during a sleepless night.
And I was just up at like 3 a.m., kind of in shock and despair and just grief, honestly.
It seemed to be a satire of how Americans and American journalists may set themselves and their nation apart from the rest of the world.
Yeah, and I'm also writing this from the experience of having reported abroad. I spent a decent amount of time in the Caribbean working with the Associated Press. I also reported in Nigeria and in Ghana. And so I'm coming at this understanding the foreign correspondees. Mm-hmm. My parents are immigrants from West Africa. And so I also come at this with the experience of having us considered in the periphery and being flattened, frankly, by media narratives that say, oh, well, Africans are diseased and poor.
You were inspired a little bit, right, by the famous Trevor Noah bit comparing Trump to an African dictator?
Yeah.
What I'm trying to say is Donald Trump is presidential. He just happens to be running on the wrong continent. In fact, once you realize that Trump is basically the perfect African president, you start to notice the similarities everywhere.
There's a history of some of these leaders proposing bogus health remedies.
The president of Gambia says he can cure AIDS with bananas. And I can also cure cancer using AIDS.
So I just kept thinking of Trump suggesting that maybe bleach could be a cure or sunlight. To me, it's just ironic, right? Because this is the president who called Africa asshole countries. But he's cut from the same cloth.
All the quotes, obviously, in the piece are made up, except those from Trump, but they clearly represent certain very real mindsets. You had Mustafa Okanga, an imaginary anthropologist, and Charlotte Johnson, an invented Liberian activist. Why did you include them? What can America learn through their eyes?
We tend to not quote African experts on America, right? We tend to quote American experts on Africa all the time, including myself. Mustafa, he's telling us that being a Black person in this world doesn't kill you, but being a Black person in America can. I guess I just wanted people to sit with that, both to underscore the sort of dual pandemics of racism and then an actual virus that is disproportionately killing us, but then also the fact that the continent that we tend to paint as disorganized, diseased, underdeveloped has been doing a much better job at managing its affairs with this deadly virus. You know, Senegal is a country of 16 million and has only had, I think, 41 deaths at this point. I think that's why satire is so useful if it can be done well, is that I can attack a multitude of cliches and absurdities and small-minded worldviews in a very short amount of time.
Your Liberian activist survived Ebola, wants to raise money for us poor Americans, says it's like they're living in a failing state.
Yeah, and that's, to be honest, how a lot of people abroad are seeing us.
Atiyah's fictional journalist cites an expert who refers to the, quote, ancient inexplicable hatreds fueling these ethnic conflicts and inequality, and captures the required range of opinions, like those of G. Scott Fitz, a, quote, Minnesotan and member of the white ethnic majority, who said that going after a target crosses the line. Can't they find a more peaceful way, like kneeling in silence?
And I've heard this from well-meaning, well-intentioned white mm-hmm. folks who, at the end of the day, we realize that any form of Black dissent is uncomfortable to white people. This idea that, you know, can't they find a more peaceful way, like kneeling in silence, obviously is a reference to Colin Kaepernick, who in 2016 took a quiet kneel during the national anthem. The NFL owners have effectively blackballed him, you know. We weren't listened to then. We were demonized then, you know, called all sorts of names by the president then. And now when buildings are burning and windows are broken, it's like, wait, but can't you go back to the other way? And it's like, that's not how protest works.
Property destruction tends to steal the focus. But in this case, I've noticed mm-hmm. that in the legacy media, whatever you want to call it, the good outlets have not allowed the breaking in at a Stop and Shop become the lead of the story.
I think, frankly, what's happening right now is that Black journalists and journalists of color, like, we are tired. We are exhausted. Perhaps I would personally say maybe even like 6 or 7 years ago, the coverage would have been, this is violence. We must condemn. We must protect all Stop and Shops. Stop and Shops don't deserve this. Stop and Shops have human rights.
Stop and Shops are people too.
Right. And I think now, I mean, we saw this with the Philadelphia Inquirer just this week, where they tried the nonsense with that headline saying, buildings matter too. The Black journalist staged a virtual walkout.
The fact that Black journalists and white journalists at the New York Times spoke out against the publishing of Tom Cotton's op-ed to send in the military suggests that those who are not likely to be directly affected, like white people, understand that this isn't just a theoretical idea of the misuse of the military in violation of the Constitution, that this literally puts Black people in danger. I was just wondering whether the sense of solidarity that I like to see as a white person is real. What do you think?
It matters. Your question as to when you see the crowds being diverse, it matters a whole lot. I think Black people are tired because we felt like we've carried this burden by ourselves for a long time. And this is just how I feel. Now, I will say this sort of solidarity and empathy and willingness to listen should be happening in peacetime, not just when we're in a public health crisis and battles on the streets.
Obviously, the word you choose to describe what's happening is a powerful signifier. Atlantic writer Megan Garber detests the word chaos because it suggests that the meaning and the message of the protests are obscured in a fog. When the New York Times referred this week to chaos in a headline, it caused an outcry. The first, but not the only time this week. The Washington Post used chaos too, and the Associated Press, and President Trump. But this is not chaos, wrote Garber, and to dismiss the protests in that way as swirling eddies of inscrutability is to erase their message. Meanwhile, clash is a word Karen Atiyah would never apply.
The word clash, frankly, whitewashes the lethal power that we've given to the police, and not just the power, but impunity. That's why I'm very conscious of changing, I guess maybe you call it a bit of a language revolution, that I can do my part to shift frames. My use of the word uprising is maybe partially because I'm borrowing it from our foreign correspondentees, so partially that, but also because I honestly do think this is an effort to overthrow a system, systemic racism. Ferguson happened under Obama's watch, and we still went to the streets, still trying to overthrow ideologies, to clean out, again, not only police departments of quote-unquote bad apples, but to shake certain toxic foundations, right? And I think this time, even now, again, it feels different. It is not standard operating procedure for Black journalists to publicly say they are staging walkouts of their media employers. And I know there are going to be people who do not survive this, whether that is literally physically losing their lives to the coronavirus or in the streets, or if it's losing their jobs due to the virus or due to speaking out. A lot of us are at great risk right now, but things are going to be different, and you just hope that we can do what we can to make sure that difference is a better one.
Karen Atiyah is the Washington Post's global opinions editor. Her book about the murdered Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, called Say Your Word and Leave, is due out early next year. Coming up, enforcing a system that works well enough for some Americans and horribly for others at a high cost to both. This is On the Media.